Okay, welcome. My name's Judy Hunter. I'm a professor in the Department of Physical Therapy at the University of Toronto and also at the Faculty of Rehabilitation Sciences at the University of Alberta. And today's topic is medical marijuana. It's a very current topic. There's been a number of changes in the laws around medical marijuana and affects the people we see and their access to it. And I think it's a very topical topic for us to discuss. So our guest today, who's an expert and can give us lots of information, is Dr. Laurie Montgomery. And she's a family physician. She was trained at the University of Calgary and did the pain fellowship in Calgary. And her clinical practice now includes patients with neuromusculoskeletal pain and headache at the Chronic Pain Center in Calgary, where she is medical director. And she also treats hospital inpatients with the Chronic Pain Consult Service and the three acute care hospitals there. She's involved in teaching of medical students, residents, practicing professionals, and often a guest speaker in our pain certificate course at the University of Alberta. So welcome, Laurie. Thank you for coming.
Happy to be here.
So as I said, our topic today is medical marijuana, and as physical therapists, we're often asked by our patients about alternative methods, which they see medical marijuana as, for pain management. And often we see patients who may be asking for us to advocate them with their family docs. And so we need to be able to respond appropriately. We need to know the best evidence and be able to separate out hype that's on the internet. And we also have to work within our scope of practice. So I have a number of questions to ask you about medical marijuana, the difference between it and pharmaceutical cannabinoid preparations, as well as the most current evidence on its effectiveness. We need to know when to advocate for the patient, and we need to know when to help them move on. So first of all, what I wanted to ask you about, though, is it's in the press a lot now, and I think it's in because of the change in the regulations. The new Health Canada regulations have replaced these older ones called the Medical Marijuana Access Program. So I wonder if we could start just by you telling our members about these new regulations and how it changes how individual patients get access to medical marijuana.
Sure. And you're right. Access to marijuana for medical purposes in Canada isn't new. So we've done that since about 2001. But under the old program, the way it worked was a patient would go to their physician and get a form signed indicating that somebody thought that marijuana was an appropriate treatment for them. It had to be also signed by a specialist to certify that other things had been tried and that this was a reasonable next step. And then you would send that into Health Canada. Health Canada ultimately would be the one who decided whether you were authorized, and you would get a little card that said that you were authorized to possess marijuana. So you could either buy that directly from Health Canada. Frankly, what a lot of patients did was just access it the way they normally got their marijuana, from a street supply. Or you could get seeds from Health Canada, and you could grow it yourself. And so under the new system, Health Canada is pretty much taking themselves out of the picture, other than licensing producers to actually grow and distribute marijuana. So the way it works now is that the patient goes to see their physician. The physician signs a form, again, saying that they feel it's an appropriate therapy. Doesn't need to be signed by a specialist. But that form goes directly to one of the licensed producers, who then sells the product directly to the patient. So Health Canada's only role in this now is regulating the licensed producers, and they're theoretically, under the new regulations, is no such thing as the home grow-ops anymore. I should say there's a court case pending right now. Someone has challenged that. So in the meantime, for the time being, there's an injunction in place allowing people who had a home grow up to be able to keep that until the court case is settled.
Thank you. So really now the patient gets a script like any other pharmacological intervention, a script from their family doc. And so they're placing, are you saying it's placing the responsibility now solely on the family doctor?
It is. And it is, it can be any physician, but for the most part, it is family physicians who are going to be responsible for this. It's a medical document. It's not really a prescription. So, you know, we'll probably talk more about dosing and things like that you would write on a regular prescription. So this is a little bit different. Really, the only thing you have to say is how many grams or milligrams you think that the patient is going to use and for how long you want them to use it.
And I see that the College of Family Physicians, I noticed in September, put out what's called a preliminary guidance document for this authorizing of dried cannabis. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little more about that document? And I know you were part of the team. Mm-hmm. And why it's labeled a preliminary guidance document?
Yes. Well, I mean, I think it came together mainly because the College of Family Physicians was hearing a lot from family doctors across the country about the fact that they felt really uncertain about how to approach this problem. So, you know, what do I say when a patient comes in and asks me about this? You know, we don't know anything really about what advice we should give a patient, yes or no. And, you know, what conditions is it good for? And if it's good, how much should you use? And what are the risks? And so family doctors really were asking the college to try to put together something that would give them some guidelines to work within. When we sat down and started talking about this document, though, I think everybody was really clear that we didn't want to call that a clinical practice guideline because there's really nothing like the level of evidence that you would require to build an actual clinical practice guideline. So we all understand that the research is rapidly evolving, but we also recognize that we can't really wait for answers to the questions before we start to tell people how to approach the problem. So we had to come up with something that would be, you know, in the interim, something that would give people something to go on with the understanding that this is going to have to evolve quickly over time as the research becomes available.
So this is a guideline, as you say, for medical marijuana. But already physicians have been prescribing cannabinoids. And just to be clear, can you describe the difference between medical marijuana and these pharmaceutical preparations? Often they're mentioned in the same context. Are they one and the same? And I'm thinking of not only the treatment, but the research behind. So is research about cannabinoids, the pharmaceutical, does that apply to medical marijuana? Or how are the two related?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you're right that there's a lot of confusion. When people talk about cannabinoids, that's a big umbrella term that covers the pharmaceutical products as well as cannabis, dried cannabis or marijuana. So when people talk about cannabinoid research, there actually is a large body of cannabinoid research. People have been looking at cannabinoid receptors in your body and how those operate for a good number of years. But you're right that there is a distinction. So we have two pharmaceutical cannabinoids that are available in Canada. One of them is nabilone, which is synthetic THC. And the other one is nabiximols, which is a buccal spray of THC and cannabidiol. So THC and cannabidiol are two of the cannabinoids that are in cannabis, in marijuana. So when you smoke marijuana, you're taking in hundreds of chemical compounds. 60 or 70 of them are cannabinoids, and only two of them we really know too much about. That's THC and cannabidiol, or CBD. So there is a fairly significant body of research behind nabilone and nabiximols. So, you know, a number of trials, of some marketing history, some safety information that we can draw on to make some decisions about whether to use that. Much less in the realm of actual dried cannabis or marijuana.
And so really the two are separate, is that what you're saying?
I consider them very separate. I mean, we can think about them both acting potentially on cannabinoid receptors, but in the case of marijuana, also potentially on a whole bunch of other things. that we really don't know very much about.
So you're taking in a milkshake of different chemicals with the... It's less specific, or...?
It is. I think it's less specific.
And also, a lot of the research that's out there is not necessarily for pain, and we're focusing on pain. So just taking out the other research about other aspects of cannabinoids, medical marijuana, just for medical marijuana, can you briefly summarize the proven risks and benefits that we know about medical marijuana for patients?
Well, that's actually a really short answer, and that is nothing. There's really nothing that we can say absolutely for certain about the long-term risks or benefits of using marijuana. The studies that we have some evidence of the risks of using marijuana that are largely drawn from addiction populations of people who are in treatment programs for cannabis use disorder. We have some information on risks in terms of cardiac and pulmonary effects and things that, again, have been observed in people who are using marijuana recreationally. In terms of the benefits, we have a very small handful of studies that were done in a very strict research context in very small populations of people. So, you know, some of these studies are 8 people or 20 people or those kinds of numbers, and they're all 5 days or less in duration. So what happens 3 months down the road even, we don't really know.
That I'm surprised to hear that, because if you go online anywhere almost, you see this article from Lancet quoted. It's saying that marijuana relieves pain in virtually every test that scientists use to measure pain relief. And now you're saying the evidence is non-existent. Can you help our listeners with that contrast?
Well, in that particular case, that's a quote that's taken out of context from the original article. So the original article was a basic science paper that was looking at the mechanisms by which cannabinoids probably have their analgesic effect. And they were saying that in most of the studies that have been done looking at the analgesic effects of cannabinoids, they seem to do that via cannabinoid receptors. And yes, we all agree on that. But a lot of those are, again, they're animal studies or they're theoretical constructs about how these medications work. They're not actually randomized controlled trials. And so that's part of the problem, is that when you look, you know, when you do a Google search of virtually any condition and marijuana, you'll find some case reports of people who found it helpful. But that level of evidence, that's really from a healthcare provider perspective, that's really just the first step, listening to patients and what they tell us about what they experience with things like marijuana is the first step in trying to figure out how to use it therapeutically. It's not the whole story. So we need to follow that up with some randomized controlled trials and evidence of that caliber.
I understand that, but your reference to the internet is interesting, because our patients come in and they've looked at the internet, and we've heard about medical marijuana. We've heard about marijuana for years, and that it's been around, it should be legalized, etc. And there's several rumors that come up on the internet. And one that I read last week, someone posted, well, you know, the medical establishment, you can't get funding for studies on medical marijuana. They only will fund negative studies, and that's why there's nothing out there. And these rumors fly, and I wonder, how do you respond when people bring in stories like this from the internet, that there's a great conspiracy to prevent patients from getting medical marijuana?
Well, I mean, I think that, like everything on the internet, there's a bit of truth in that. So it is very difficult to do research on marijuana in most places in the world. Probably in Canada, we're very well placed to do some of that research that needs to be done, because we have a mechanism in place for using it for medical purposes. For example, in the United States, although we hear a lot about legalization of marijuana in certain states, federally, it's still illegal in the U.S., and so you can't create a research study around marijuana in the U.S. because it's illegal federally. So, and that's the case in a lot of countries. So, you know, around the world, there are a limited number of places where you can actually do a randomized controlled trial of marijuana, which is what we need in order to demonstrate benefits. So what that means is that the research that is funded in most places is probably addictions research. So it's probably addiction specialists and psychiatrists and so on studying populations of people who have cannabis use disorder. So, you know, sure, they are going to come up with more information about the risks of marijuana because that's what they're studying, is the risks. It has been legitimately harder to study the benefits in most places, but, you know, that is changing. And certainly there is a groundswell of support for more studies of the potential benefits of marijuana. We're just not there yet. I wouldn't say it's a conspiracy, though.
It's quite an emotional argument that you see on the internet often. So I can really appreciate why these preliminary guidance document came out. And so given that document and the evidence, as you say it is, why and how would a family doc go ahead and agree to prescribe medical marijuana? What would the family doc consider to say, okay, yes, I will move ahead and give a trial of medical marijuana with this patient?
There are a lot of pieces of information to consider if you're thinking about that. One of the things that I think is important, and I must say not everyone agrees with me on this, but I think it's important to look at the studies that have been done and where they've shown benefit. And really the only studies we have demonstrating benefit of marijuana in pain are in neuropathic pain conditions. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's important to start with, does this patient have a condition where we have some evidence that it might be helpful? So, you know, that might be my first question. And have they tried all of the evidence-based therapies for that condition, first of all, before we'd be moving on to think about something that we have a lot of questions about, like marijuana? And then do they have any contraindications to it? So are there reasons in either their past history or the way that they use substances currently, or the risk factors that they have that would mean that marijuana wouldn't be wise for them?
And what would those risk factors, what are the main risk factors?
Well, I think one of the most important ones is there's some pretty clear evidence that young people, children and adolescents should not use it. And there is a growing body of evidence that would say that we really shouldn't think about marijuana for people under age 25, because your brain is developing quite a lot up until that point, and there is some evidence that your neural development is adversely affected by marijuana. There's definitely a link between the use of marijuana and development of psychotic symptoms in people who are prone to that, or have family histories or have risk factors. There's really not enough evidence yet to say that it's causal, but there's certainly a link that's strong enough that we have to be cautious about that. Somebody where you have some evidence that they are abusing medications or street drugs at the time that you see them, certainly feeding that with cannabis is a bad idea. You would probably be cautious about somebody who's got a strong substance abuse history, even if it's in the background, would be something to be careful about. You don't want to give it to anybody who's pregnant or breastfeeding, or men who are considering having a family, because it has some adverse effects there too. There's some suggestions of cardiac effects that you probably wouldn't want to make worse with cannabis. Mm-hmm. And, of course, if you're talking about somebody who's smoking marijuana, there are pulmonary risks, respiratory risks. So we want to recommend that they vaporize it rather than smoke it, and probably shouldn't do that if they already have significant respiratory disease.
So on that respiratory disease, often the flippant answer that you get from patients or people that you speak to, they say, well, the studies show that smoking is worse for your lungs than marijuana. Is there any evidence about the effect of the marijuana, inhaling marijuana, on the mobility of cilia or anything else like that in your lungs?
Yeah. So, I mean, when people quote that, they're usually talking about the studies looking at lung cancer. And it is true that it looks like the lung cancer risk is certainly greater with smoking tobacco than it is with marijuana. But that does leave aside the question of COPD and you know, as you say, you know, movement of cilia and all kinds of other issues that impact your lung health. So burning something and inhaling it is bad for your lungs. That's bottom line. So it doesn't matter whether it's tobacco or marijuana or anything else. So the risks of that are definitely decreased if you vaporize rather than smoke it.
So can you tell me a little bit more about the vaporizer? Burn it cooler, or how does the vaporizer work, and where do patients, is this something that the family doc prescribes or discuss?
The patient can purchase that almost anywhere. There are supply stores all over really every city that I've ever been in where you can purchase those. And the idea is that nothing is burned at all. So the cannabis is heated to a point where the oils evaporate and you inhale just the active components without actually combusting anything at all. And so there have been a couple of studies that have shown that the serum levels of THC are identical between smoking and vaporizing. And so given the fact that the pulmonary risks are a lot lower with vaporizing, then that's what we'd probably recommend.
So that's interesting when you talk about the serum levels, because the next question I was thinking about was about dose. And how do you standardize a dose, or how do you know, how does the physician prescribe a dose, do a trial to see if the dose should be increased or decreased? Can you tell me about dosage?
Sure. I can tell you what little we know, which is not very much. The studies that have been done of sort of randomized controlled trials in pain for cannabis use a relatively low concentration of THC. So a number of them use concentrations of 2% or 3% or 5%, those kinds of things. One of them used a concentration up to 9.4%. And so we, from that perspective, we generally would say start with, and then the studies looking at 2 or 3% THC did show an analgesic effect. So we would generally say start with a very low concentration and give that a trial first before you start to increase the THC. A number of those studies used a very low dose in terms of milligrams. So, you know, on the order of 50, 100 milligrams of the product. So if you look at the preliminary guidance document from the CFPC, there are some guidelines there around asking a patient to start with a low THC product, start with one puff and see how it affects them, and then assess it from there. I have a number of patients who tell me that they use one puff at night, maybe a couple of times a week, and that's all they need to help them get off to sleep and to help control their symptoms. There's a lot of, when you talk to patients about how much they're currently using, it's typically a lot more than that if they're using it recreationally, for sure. Mm-hmm. So I have patients who sometimes will come and ask for 6 or 7 or 8 grams per day of marijuana, which is certainly beyond a level where we think that they're probably getting some benefits of that that are not entirely analgesic. And also the THC concentration currently under the marijuana for medical purposes regulations, there isn't really a mechanism for the physician to even prescribe a concentration of THC. You can suggest it. But the patient can actually purchase whatever concentration of THC they want from the licensed producer. So you can suggest that they start with 2 or 3% THC, but they can buy 20 or 24% THC if they want.
So I have a little trouble understanding that. You're really not controlling the dose then, are you? If you're just saying grant the amount of weight and not the percent of THC?
Yes. Yeah, it's sort of like writing a prescription for Oxyneo and saying, I would like you to have 20 tablets, but I don't care what the dose is. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense. The other side of that is there's very little evidence to guide what our recommendations should be about what that percentage should be. And really, the other piece of that is, what about the cannabidiol component? We don't really know anything about that in the pain world. There really haven't been any pain studies that have looked at that. So what to suggest in terms of, most of the licensed producers give you a product that's a balance between THC and CBD, but we don't really know what to suggest in terms of CBD.
So there's lots of evidence that is needed.
Yes, lots of research that needs to be done.
So we've gone ahead and decided, the family doc's gone ahead and decided to do a trial of medical marijuana. What are the recommendations on the logical approach to going ahead with this?
Well, as I say, first to establish that they have a condition that you think is going to be helped by marijuana. Make sure that they don't have contraindications. You have to make sure that they understand what we know about the risks of using marijuana. So, you need to be able to have a good conversation with them about, so that that you have informed consent. So I don't think it's enough to just sort of say, we don't know very much, so you're taking a big risk. We have to let them know that there are potential cardiac risks, potential respiratory risks, that there are potential mood problems, making depression or anxiety worse, that there is a potential for addiction. Establish those things, establish some rules around whether the patient is going to drive or not, or when they're going to or not going to. So those kinds of discussions, it's a fairly lengthy conversation about what things the patient needs to be aware of before they start. And then we would suggest starting with a low concentration THC and a low dose in terms of milligrams per day, and set some functional goals with the patient so that you have a sense of what are you not able to do because of pain right now that you would like to be able to do if this is successful. Mm-hmm. So you have some way of measuring whether or not it's been useful. And we also would suggest that when you fill out the medical document, rather than giving it to the patient to send away, that you mail it yourself to the licensed producer so that it can't be altered. And then follow up with the patient regularly. So, depending on how you're titrating that dose, that might be every couple of weeks, it might be once a month, to try to get a sense of whether or not it's been helpful and whether their function is improving with it.
The functional goals that you're talking about, that's interesting because that raises the rest of the healthcare team into action. Is there anything we should be cognizant of or aware of while the individual is undergoing this trial?
Well, I think in addition to trying to be really concrete about whether or not they're actually meeting their functional goals, just watching for some of those things that can be the adverse effects of marijuana, in particular the things like the mood effects, exacerbation of depression or anxiety, some indication that they're overusing or not using it appropriately, sedation, disorientation, those kinds of things. It's the same as with any medication, the things that we, are potential side effects, but hopefully if we dose it properly we can avoid. The goal is that we get to a point with cannabis where we know how to dose it so that we minimize those side effects while maximizing whatever analgesic effects there are. So in that sense, I think it's very similar to any other medication.
Mm-hmm. And the other, where can we point patients for information? Because when I look on the internet, I find mostly information from advocacy groups and people who have whose business is growing or selling or developing cannabinoids. Where can we point patients to get some balanced information?
Well, I sometimes give people the Health Canada site. They have a patient handout that they have prepared. It's very thorough and comprehensive, but it's at a very high reading level, so that's not always, depending on the patient, not always appropriate. sometimes I will give them the College of Physicians and Surgeons website, because that also has some information for them about how their physician is meant to approach the idea of authorizing cannabis. And I just the other day, actually, for the first time, I gave the patient the CFPC document to website to look at, because I think it's important that the patient understand the concerns that we have about authorizing, so that they understand that, you know, again, it isn't a big internet conspiracy, and we don't hate them. We are trying to keep them safe.
And just mentioning that, where, how do we get to the CFPC website? Because it would be good for our listeners to see the preliminary guidance document too.
The college website is cfpc.ca.
Okay.
But if you just Google that preliminary guidance document on dried cannabis, it is the first hit that comes up.
Great. Thank you. Well, that's been very informative. I know we get a lot of questions from patients about it, and there's a lot of misinformation out there. So I really, really appreciate you taking the time to answer these questions. And I think it's given us some very good information, and I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
No problem. Anytime.
Okay. Well, we'll let you go back to your snowstorm.
Yeah, yes. It's a little bit hideous, but it's all right. You have your own snow to deal with, so.
Thank you. Thanks, Lori.
Okay, have a good day.
You too.
Okay.
Bye.